This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 21. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by Giles Andrews, CEO and co-founder of Zupa. Such is the depth of my research, brackets, Wikipedia, brackets, I even found out amazingly that Zupa is an acronym, which stands for Zone of Possible Agreement, quotes, a negotiating term identifying the bounds within which the agreement can be reached between two parties. Who said I don't provide my esteemed listeners with useful information on fintech? Giles and friends have really set one of the all-time FS innovation high watermarks with their invention of P2P, online non-bank lending and borrowing. They literally have created a global industry, as we've seen with the multi-billion dollar IPOs in the US in December 14. As they were the first, they've always had a core of getting it right, aka not losing customers' money, aka getting high-quality consumer credit right. This they've certainly done, as they still produce positive returns of over 4% through the mega consumer crisis of 2008. Not just that, but they really get 21st century customer business and have won the Best Loan Provider Award 5 years in a row. 58,000 lenders have put money through their platform. One of the sad things about being the first in anything is that one starts with a market share of 100%, which can only then go down. Set against this, based on my far more modest invention of a category that didn't exist before, strategic, not tactical risk information, in passing, there is an advantage when others join the party. Prior to this, one spends all one's time explaining the concept and not your business. According to the excellent Liberum Altfi Data UK Volume Index, back in the day, Zupa did indeed have 100% market share. It still now has more than 50% of all consumer P2P deals done to date, roughly 750 million out of a total of £1.3 billion. Although more recently, they've been growing more slowly than Ratesetter, who've got the noses ahead in terms of originations. Over the past few decades, having seen many times the world's biggest bank then hit rocky shores, it's not entirely obvious that being the biggest is always a good plan. Going for creating quantity in anything, be it loans or cheese, always leads to a lowering of quality. However, I'll be interested to hear, Giles, on whether a decade-long trend of a market share falling from 100% will continue, stop, or be reversed, and whether sticking with the highest quality credits at some point gets to be a limiting factor. So let's get on with the show. Hi, Giles. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks, Mike. It's really good to be here. And I've been reading your blogs recently, so I'm quite looking forward to trying to challenge some of your, what I might call, cynicism.
As you'll find when all your sort of hair and teeth fall out like mine have a long time ago, there's a problem with being old and wise. There's a benefit of being old and wise and that you're wise. And the problem is that all the young whippersnappers don't believe you. Certainly my teenage daughters don't.
I think you might be amused to hear that I'm very similar in age to you, so.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, you're just sort of young and handsome looking, you see, as opposed to old and decrepit. Now, obviously, you're using your sort of deep background because you started in experimental psychology, which you've already got me with, and then you moved on to INSEAD, and then, as the legends have it, you became a car salesman.
Well, I didn't become a car salesman after INSEAD. It's probably slightly debatable whether I ever did become a car salesman.
Well, you were at Oxford, which was a car town.
Yes, I was at Oxford. I made the very unusual career choice of leaving Oxford and going into work in the motor trade. And I've been incredibly lucky, actually, throughout my career in doing things that I really enjoy. When I was at university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was pretty confident I didn't want to become an accountant, a lawyer, a banker, or a consultant.
And no one offered you the choice of being P2P?
No one offered me the choice of being a peer-to-peer lender, no. But I knew I had a passion for cars, and I actually sort of managed to find a way to indulge that passion and managed to awaken my interest in business through being passionate about the commodity.
What was your
selling.
First car? I mean, on Top Gear's criterion that you really are a car buff, if your first car was an Alfa Romeo, mine was an Alfa Sud, so I can claim that I am on the Top Gear criterion.
So my first car was Italian, and it was a very small, bright yellow Fiat 126, was the much inferior follow-on to the Fiat 500. And it was known as Busby, because if you may remember, there was a character that advertised British Telecom, which was a little bird called Busby. Yes. So my car was affectionately known as Busby.
Not that that's girly, giving your car a name, of course.
No, of course not. No, in fact, I didn't give it the name. It was given a name by, funnily enough, a girl.
Oh, really? Well, there we go. That explains a lot. Well, we better move on, otherwise your wife will be on the phone to me. Well, actually, my Alfa Sud had a very nice flat four boxer engine, which has got a lovely sound, actually. The rest of it kept falling apart. And I remember once I was living in Maida Vale, and I had to be best man at a wedding down in the West Country, and there wasn't much petrol in. I went to the garage, and the petrol cap wouldn't come off. It just wouldn't open.
I think my greatest claim to fame, actually, in the car world was I'm sufficiently anoraki to go on car rallies, I'm afraid. And I did a car rally in an Alfa Sud Ti.
Oh, right, that's why I had, yeah.
Which I think had a 1.2-litre engine. And I managed to overtake a Ferrari on Thruxton race circuit, which gave me enormous pleasure.
Wow, that's pretty brilliant, actually.
I think it's more a function of quite how ineptly the Ferrari is being driven rather than a measure of my talent.
One of my daughters goes to school in Caterham.
Right, I owned and actually very badly raced Caterhams in my time.
Oh, really?
And I think they're wonderful machines.
Well, I'd better move you on, because otherwise we'll have a very interesting conversation about cars and the audience will feel swindled out of an equally interesting and fascinating conversation about consumer credit in P2P. So moving away from the motor car, what were the origins of all this sort of P2P stuff? I mean, did you just wake up in the middle of night at 3 o'clock in the morning and think, oh, I know, I'm going to invent P2P today. Today is a good day in my diary.
I think the first thing to say is a clear disclaimer that it wasn't my idea. So the idea for P2P came from a guy called Dave Nicholson, who was part of a group of people who left Egg at the end of 2003. Dave worked in the strategy team at Egg. He worked for a guy called James Alexander, who was a friend of mine, which is my introduction to the team. James, I met at INSEAD, which I went to after I managed to take a car business sort of semi-national and sell it in the late 90s. And James's boss at Egg was a guy called Richard Duval, who was one of two people who could claim to have created Egg, the other being Mike Harris. Richard sadly died in 2006, but Richard was our first CEO. And Dave came up with this idea, which was interestingly called Rialto at the time, Rialto being the bridge that links two market squares in Venice. When we researched the name Rialto, everyone said it sounded like a sort of downmarket version of an American estate agency, so we had to think again. But the idea was really simple, which was, well, I suppose, taking a number of different influences and coming up with a consumer proposition. The first one being an observation that there's a thing called the bond market that's effectively replaced banks for large corporate lending. Could we replace the bond market? Could we create something a bit like the bond market at consumer level? That's pretty dry.
That's very interesting, because actually I was just tweeting this morning about mini bonds. So it's kind of going full circle.
I think the mini bond phenomenon is somewhat different in the sense that
it's more on the equity side of the fence.
Yeah, but I think if you take the original bond market and the bond market that still exists, clearly, for large companies, you've got a highly liquid market with huge amounts of capital and lots of data that allows people to make predictive decisions reasonably about credit risk. And that's something I think we'll come back to. A theme we'll come back to in this podcast. But our simple challenge was, can we create a bond market for consumers? I think that's a really difficult proposition to sell. I think it sounds really economic and very dry. The idea was helped by the sort of second leg, which was looking at eBay, which by 2004 was the largest online marketplace in the world. And you couldn't explain eBay's amazing growth just on the back of value and utility, sort of Tesco, Walmart type value and utility. There's something else going on. And we actually postulated that it was something social. And bear in mind, this is pre-Zuckerberg. But we thought consumers were enjoying some kind of social return that went above the purely economic and rational.
Which is kind of where Prosper came from. It's a very social site in this.
Yeah, so we should come back to that as well, because I think they took that a stage too far.
Yeah.
But our view was you could create something that was much more interesting to consumers as long as it had the sound economics and the foundation of this bond market for consumer idea. You could create a sort of social layer on top that would make it more appealing. And the third leg was a thought really most put forward by Richard, wearing his sort of Egg research hat, was that there was a fundamental change in demographics and there was a new generation of consumer emerging who very much wanted to take more control over what they did and what they bought and how they behaved. And I think you've seen that in disintermediation of established industries, in the sense people have gone for self-assembly, if you wanted to put it simply.
The empowered consumer.
Yeah, the empowered consumer.
I always come back to the travel market, and you know, I don't go anywhere these days without checking it out on TripAdvisor
exactly.
or something like that.
So previous generation would buy their holidays from Air Tours or from Thomas Cook or whatever, and it would be a package. And now we assemble our own holidays based on our own research and other consumer feedback as a completely different proposition. And that proposition was beginning to take hold in various industries, travel being one, music being another obvious one. So people, you know, listen to tracks they download from iTunes, they don't buy the album, they're sold by EMI. And our argument was that simply didn't exist in financial services. And if you look at what was happening then, the vanguard, probably led by Fred Goodwin of RBS, who had an activity in the bank called manufacturing. And I actually did some work as a consultant in 2002-03, which exposed me to RBS. RBS was never a client, but I was exposed to them. And I remember going to see these manufacturing facilities, and the bank was proud of having the lowest cost of manufacturing. And what that means is, well, they're selling the same product to everybody, no customization. It's the complete antithesis. So they were 10 years behind the times. They were therefore oblivious to this massive change in consumer behavior.
So they were still producer driven. We're the producers. We're building a factory to churn out the goods cheaper than ever before.
Yeah.
Whereas the Egg folks, and I know Mike Harris and heard his side of the story as one. He was the chief executive of Egg. They were coming from much more consumer driven focus.
So they had much more insight. They were more insight driven, but ultimately they were still manufacturers. So Richard was keen to take that a stage further and say, well, I've got all this insight, but how can I now use this insight to develop a product that people co-create to some extent and feel they're responsible for?
Right. Interesting. Interesting. I mean, the Fred Goodwin, just in passing, the media loves the Manichaean view of the world, the goodies and the baddies and the heroes and the zeros. And Fred was a hero for a long time and is now a zero. But I remember talking about exposure to RBS quite some time ago. When I left and started becoming an independent, well, I became an independent in 1998, I had coffee with someone who remained nameless, a well-placed source in RBS. And he told me in 1998, I said, oh, what's this Fred like? And he said, ah, he's a gambler. He said, he'll keep doubling and quitting until one day he doubles too much and then he loses. And of course, 10 years later, roughly, that then blew up.
Well, I remember coming down on an aeroplane from Edinburgh thinking, if I knew more about the stock market and I had the funds, this is a stock to short, because it is, and this was 2002 when they were flying high.
So you lost a lot of money for a while and then made a lot.
Well, I didn't do it because I didn't know enough about how it all worked, and I probably wasn't brave enough. But yes, I would have lost money had I done that short and probably not been able to afford to sit it out to the time when you would have made a huge amount of money.
So one thing that came out of these origins that you're describing, and I hadn't heard a lot of the colour of the background, which is very interesting, was that, as I referred to in the introduction, many people in the world of fintech today just misunderstand innovation and they want to create something completely unique that no one's ever done before, but they don't realise that sort of be careful what you wish for, you might actually get it. Because having got something like that, you end up having to do this thing that I call it an evangelical sell. You've got to go around explaining the gospels to people, and only then can you start talking about your own church, as it were. So at the beginning, you must have made some fundamental decisions, not least of which is you wanted to get everything right, because it'd be really difficult explaining a new concept to people if the thing started leaking.
Yeah, so I think there's a mixture of pragmatism and our own natural conservatism. So the pragmatism was in acknowledging that we were creating an entirely new asset class called, you know, unsecured consumer debt as purchasable by other consumers. And it's hard enough to create an asset class when everything's going well, but the last thing you want is there to be an atmosphere of sort of default and noise. And if you believe your behavioural economics, then you'll understand that we all relate to our losses much more highly than our gains.
So going back to eBay, for example, which I don't use, but you can go there and you get sort of ratings. And if you see that some vendor has got 1 star out of 5, you run a mile. And if you see that someone's got 99% from 1 million reviews.
Yeah, so we looked really hard at that and we were very disappointed to work out that actually a sort of eBay rating system wouldn't work on a peer-to-peer lending business, because it's very hard for a lender to get a positive rate. I mean, it's a bit relevant, a lender supplying money. So who's going to rate them and what's the significance of a rating to them? Because their money is as good as anybody else's. And on the borrowing side, we didn't want repeat borrowers. We love the idea of someone borrowing money for 3, 4, or 5 years and either towards the end of their loan or at the end of their loan, choosing to take another one out. Maybe they're on a 3, 4 year car change cycle.
Pressing pause there, I think, isn't car loans one of your principal activities?
Cars is, yes.
So you can't get away from cars. You
go to an,
you go to
an, avoid
you,
it.
You go
avoid
to a
it.
Sort of university which is based in a sort of a city which is centred entirely on making motor cars. You then go into the industry and now you can't get away from it.
Car loans are absolutely a bedrock of what we do. And they do have a very good characteristic, which is that people do have a change cycle. And if they have a great experience borrowing money to buy a car, then chances are they're going to buy another one. Yes, the pragmatic part of the decision was to say it doesn't make a lot of sense for the platform and the fledgling asset class to be known for the noise of loss. And so we set out with very, very high credit standards, if you like, and our risk appetite was very low. And then the conservatism took over, which I think you'll see has been a theme of the business over the whole 10-year period and will continue, which is to take that risk appetite and make damn sure that you outperform it. I often hear from people in this industry and others saying, you know, when you launch a credit business, you have to learn. And of course, your first few years results aren't great. And then over time, you learn. Well, that's just a choice.
It's also not a very good marketing line. Well, hey, I've just started a P2P. The next few years, my returns aren't going to be very good, but please invest.
We just made the other choice. And in fact, if you look at the bad debt performance of Zopa, if you're sufficiently geeky to want to do so.
I've got it printed out in front of me, Giles.
The best performing cohort of loans we ever wrote was the first one. And I think the second best performing was probably the second one. So what we did was we set a risk appetite. But in the absence of data and in the absence of knowledge about our real customers, we just have to overlay that risk appetite with an air of enormous conservatism. And then over time, as we learn, and we can come back to this, but the massive power of data, over time as we learn, we can find out things about people who we declined to lend money to, who went on to borrow somewhere else. And we can begin to learn about why we were too conservative. So I think, you know, this is back to the sort of decision of the business. You can take a decision to be overly conservative and learn how to take a bit more risk over time, which is clearly in your interest, because by being overly conservative, you're denying yourself the opportunity to do lots of business. You're going to grow more slowly. Yeah. Or you say, right, I'm going to make a bit of a splash out there and then get some money out. And by the way, this can be a reasonable strategy in some cases, particularly if you're doing it with your own money rather than...
Or it's institutional money.
Other people's money. Or even best with your own money, I would argue, if you're going to take this view. You go out there, make some loans and learn from that and build a risk model around that data. So we went for the first of those two routes. And I think that was absolutely the right thing to do. And interestingly, compare it with the approach in the US, where Prosper, who were the first people to follow us, who launched about a year after us in the US, their risk appetite was much higher. So they went out with a much higher yielding loan,
which was very much the zeitgeist in the States at the time anyway. Everyone was pushing these subprimes.
We had lots of very clever people telling us we got it wrong and that we should, you know, why on earth weren't we doing subprime lending? Because 2005, crikey, that was flavour of the month. And, you know, you'll make much more money and your lenders will make much more money if you do subprime lending.
Well, going back to your comment about my cynical views of risk, I mean, part of which is driven by having spent 30 years in the risk side of the fence. I mean, I do recall in the mid-2000s and getting on towards 2008, seeing on the front page of the FT some AAA crap, yielding LIBOR plus 1.5. And I was actually doing a gig managing some projects at the time, so I wasn't on the risk side. I looked at this and thought, what a load of cobblers. And came back to being cynical. And it's just clearly madness. I mean, if it's AAA, it's not LIBOR plus 1.5. So their models were very wrong, and they had a big problem in the States, which you managed to avoid over here. Zooming up to the hyper big picture, before we get into the sort of 2008, I think I was very surprised last year when I came across the relative default rates of unsecured consumer lending, secured real estate lending or secured anything else lending, and SME lending. And I wouldn't have guessed, and I philosophically don't still entirely understand it, that unsecured consumer lending could be so successful. Yes, because so I lend money to Mr. X. Yeah. I've got no security whatsoever. He doesn't have to repay me. He's not going to get sort of, you know, thrown in debtor's prison anymore. That doesn't exist. But obviously, if you choose the best of those, they do repay you. So just a very, very simple level. What's that about then?
So that's a really interesting point. I think it isn't intuitive and it's not well understood. But of those three asset classes you described, it is the least risky.
I know.
I think if you
touch wood,
historically speaking,
each
of them in turn. I mean, well, I think it's a number of factors at work. So one, the data on consumers is excellent and ever improving. So we know a lot about our consumers. We know a lot about their very current situation. Secondly, I think that regardless of what you might choose to learn from sort of Wonga experience, if you're lending money to people to fulfill some ambition or goal of theirs, which may, by the way, be paying off their current debts, that might be a very laudable ambition and goal, or getting married or buying a car to be close to my heart, then actually they have a very positive attitude to that debt. And whether it's because we're British, I suspect not. As human beings, we don't really like letting people down, and we take reasonable steps to avoid doing so. And we also pragmatically know that if we do get into a mess, actually it has quite big impacts on the rest of our lives. I think there's a very big contrast with both SME lending and with
it's just a business.
Property lending. So both of those asset classes on one level you would say should be lower risk, because on one hand you've got a very valuable asset and on the other hand you've got a business maybe with a track record and cash flows. But the problem is, and you as a risk person will understand that, it's the unpredictability of both those things. So the volatility of those situations is of a different league. So when we're talking about property, and actually we digress here, but one of my biggest fears, and I said it in the speech I gave at LendIt, one of my biggest fears is how a number of businesses in our sector are charging into property, either away from what they started doing or they're starting in property. And property is a very dangerous asset class. Nearly every boom bust cycle that any of us can remember has been driven by property. Property is a wonderful asset class until it isn't. And when it isn't, it's a disaster.
In the UK in particular, we've got this terrible instability.
Yeah, I think you've seen it in the US as well.
Property, not necessarily in the Frances or Germanys, though.
Possibly. So I think there's some very sensible and conservatively run businesses in my sector lending into property. And I wish them lots of luck, and some of them are really quite successful.
And also the likes of LendInvest and Christian, who was on the show in the autumn, they're coming at this whole peer-to-peer online stuff from a background of having spent a decade in the industry beforehand. So
yeah,
they know
the
industry.
Highly relevant.
As opposed to a bunch of folks who come from maybe a tech angle, say, oh, we'll get some automated valuation and, you know, da-da-da-da-da.
And what could go wrong? Because we're injecting 70% loan.
Yeah.
Could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. I mean, coming back to the consumer thing, just to sort of keep this theme of the consumer credit going. I mean, it's interesting what you say about the kind of morality of it. And I suspect this does vary, certainly between continents and probably between countries within continents. So, for example, when Iceland went bust, there's a very interesting thing in Iceland that if you've got a mortgage, your parents, it goes back to your parents. You can't do a runner. You can't stick the keys to the door and leave because actually it goes back to your parents. So that creates a whole different dynamic from here and in the probably countries where it doesn't matter so much. But we see it played at large at the moment where sort of German perspective is that they're morally right with respect to Greece. And Greece would be morally wrong to default. There's a tone of that, notwithstanding the fact, I think over the last century, there's been 200 sovereign defaults around the world. As you say, there is culturally this thing that there's some moral duty.
Yeah, so I don't know how much of it's the moral duty or how much of it is just consumers thinking, you know what, I borrowed £5,000 and if I don't pay that back, actually it has implications throughout my life. And that's not a risk worth taking. However, we're both old enough to remember, I had a mortgage at the time of the last property crash, and people very rationally were defaulting on mortgages who would probably never have defaulted on a credit card or personal loan before because their view was that their mortgage was underwater, the banks had been irresponsible to lend them the money, it wasn't their fault. It's such a significant part of their life, it was like sort of in for a penny, in for a pound, I will default on my mortgage. Yeah. At which point they're probably defaulting on everything else as well. But the catalyst or the trigger was the mortgage.
And so that raises an interesting possibility. We're sort of leaping around, but at least there's some kind of creative process of scribbling all over the whiteboard. That raises the interesting possibility that in a few years' time, peer-to-peer sites that are funded by consumer money to whatevers may well outperform those that are funded by institutional money. Because if one of your borrowers knows that on the other side of the borrowing is a human being, they may be, potentially, more feeling like they need to repay that human being as opposed to it's some hedge fund, you know, $1 billion came from the States on the platform and they don't really care about some US
hedge fund. Well, I think there might be some of that. I mean, people ask me why have our losses been so low and people don't sort of want to acknowledge perhaps it's because we're quite good at what we do. And so people are always asking me, do you think it's the human side? And maybe it's a factor. So we do know for sure, because we ask people, do you feel good about the fact you borrow money from people? Very rarely was the primary motivation for coming to Zopa. And it's not something we push terribly hard up front, you know, in the one line you can put on a Google ad. But the reason I think we've won Personal Loan Provider of the Year 5 years in a row is because apart from that, we provide great service. Once people find out that it's all about people, they sort of like that. They say they prefer paying interest to a human being than an institution. So there may be something in what you say, but I think it would be dangerous to build a business on that assumption, which sort of brings me to one of my pet hates is when people start talking about, well, peer-to-peer as an asset class is very safe, isn't it? I mean, look at all these people, they've done really well, their losses are very bad, and there's some kind of assumption that there's an asset class that's safe just because we've done such an amazingly good job of being safe on our platform.
So you have been very safe. I mean, off the top of my head, there's roughly 50 peer-to-peers, of which about five have disappeared, or there were 55, of which five have already disappeared. So again, as I always say on these shows, you know, at the moment, you're certainly fine swimming with the big boys, I think, but at the other end of the spectrum, they're actually disappearing.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the record has been there.
I think it's quite healthy that people have launched businesses and those actually that didn't look very well run. I don't think any of the businesses that disappeared did a particularly good job, and some of them, in fact, did a particularly bad job.
Yeah. Well, this is what I mean. If you're putting your money into the platforms, though.
Yes. So actually, most of those who failed behaved quite well. So they were small enough. And perhaps they hadn't taken much external consumer money on. I mean, we probably all fund our own platforms when we launch because no one's heard of us. They didn't create that problem. I think it is absolutely a risk in our industry. And I think one of the things we urge consumers to do is just try and take a look at the track record or platforms before you put money in, because past performance is no predictor of the future, but it's better than none.
Indeed, as long as the FCA doesn't keep sort of tightening the restrictions on what one's allowed to say. Of course, the track record is track record. Picking up this second element of the big picture thing about why consumer unsecured finance is far better than you might think prima facie. You said, you know, if you're defaulting, it ruins the rest of your life. Now, I'm not really an expert in kind of consumer credit as such, but in the States, they've got these FICO scores, and not just they've got these FICO scores, but everyone kind of knows about FICO scores, and they're mentioned quite a lot, and it's quite a big deal, and all that kind of thing, and oh my God, my FICO score.
I think people talk about their FICO score at dinner parties, but then Americans also tell each other what they earn, which is another
slightly exactly. weird thing. I'm earning nothing so far doing this podcast. It's a pure act of charity or slash madness or both at the same time. In the UK, though, we don't talk about FICO scores at dinner or in general. I don't even know what my credit score is. So how aware are people of what their credit scores are behind the scenes? And maybe get onto the sort of sources of data like these Equifax and all these kind of stuff.
There's no comparator to a FICO score. So FICO effectively creates a score on the same scale using a variety of different data sources. So that FICO, as far as I know, is not a credit bureau. It's a sort of scoring business. And it takes data from some of the same agencies we use in the UK, like Equifax and Experian, for example. But in the UK, all the bureaus produce a variety of different scores. So I think Equifax produce about 15 scores. And as a business, you buy both a mixture of their raw data and you may or may not buy one of their scores. If you buy a score, you probably buy the score that is most calibrated to your target audience. But actually, the score really is their algorithm and their credit model. It's using their raw data to build their own score. And I think probably most platforms earlier on in their development are driven more by the scores they buy from the bureau, and over time, less and less.
Yeah, so they start developing their own credit model, basically.
Yes, and the input for their first credit model might be the score plus a few other things, and the input for their later credit models might be just the raw data.
Right.
What that means, unhelpfully for consumers, is there isn't this concept of I'm a 623. And in fact, when you go to the bureau as a consumer and say, ah, oh, you know, they all offer consumer products, you can get a score, and that score, I don't want to say it's deliberately misleading, but it's not very helpful. And it's not necessarily calibrated on the same way.
So, for example, I default on a loan somewhere else, and then I apply to you guys or somebody else on the platform. Then in the data that you're getting, you will find out about that and go, oh, it's a no-no because he's defaulted.
Well, we will find out about what's going on in your current life and what you've done in the past number of years.
Right, okay. So, as I say, I've never really been in these kind of things other than taking mortgages out. So this is, as you say, a reason why people want to repay their loans, because they know if they don't repay the loan, that bed smell is going to hang around for a long time to come.
So back to your question. So while I don't know what my credit score is, I've got a pretty good idea of
whether you've defaulted or not.
My credit file, because I know what relationships I've had with credit providers over the years. And I think there is a sort of an understanding in most consumers of roughly where they sit on a pecking order. And you see that actually by, if you talk to people like Money Supermarket, you know, not everyone clicks on the cheapest loan because they know that they wouldn't get it. Money Supermarket have a number of different areas on the site for sort of very prime credits and less prime credits, and you know, people self-select. So people have an understanding, even if it's not a numerical score.
I think they certainly have something in the big picture. I mean, I was looking at something recently, I forgot what it was. So that the detailed picture, we can't really know. So I think some agencies or banks or whatever, or ratings things, or I don't know what, even what they were. Basically, I got the idea that if I go and apply to loans a whole bunch of places, then my credit score deteriorates because it looks like I'm going around and can't get it. So there's lots of subtleties in the system.
Yeah, and that's something that really I find very frustrating. That's a sort of phenomenon created by the banks. So I don't know when, probably before we launched, so maybe 15 years ago, there was a big movement led by consumer people saying you shouldn't be penalised for shopping around. You don't, when you walk down the high street,
go down the shoe shop.
When you walk into the fourth shop, they don't say, sorry, we won't let you try one because we know you've already tried three pairs on. But you're right, an application for credit sits on someone's credit file, and the banks can choose to mark that negatively, and do. And therefore, there was a sort of a view in the industry that that was okay, because you in some way were obligating your customer to take the first or second
quote. Once you've gone through the door, you're a bit stuck. Yeah.
So nothing to do with Zopa, but there was pressure put on the bureau and the financial providers to come up with a different type of credit search, which is known as a soft search, which doesn't leave the same negative footprint on your file. And then all banks were given the choice, do they want to buy soft searches or hard searches? 15 years later, funnily enough, they're all still buying hard searches. Right. And when challenged about this, they say, oh, it was very difficult from an IT perspective, you know. So to my knowledge, we launched with soft searches, always thought it was an important part of our philosophy, if you like. One or two credit card companies, including ironically Barclaycard, owned by a big bank, use soft searches. And some of the mutual sector, Nationwide Building Society, use soft searches. The Co-op Bank used to use soft searches, but that's about it. People who've launched in peer-to-peer following us typically have followed our lead and use soft searches as well. But the numbers of people doing it are absolutely tiny.
So that may be an advantage for people who've gone around without realising. They try to shop around for the best deal. They've got hit by these hard searches, that then maybe they're getting more of a chance for going into the peer-to-peer sector if they're doing soft searches.
I think everyone should go to providers who offer soft searches for that reason.
Yes. So coming on to the 2008 and how you're doing things well, as you explained, then, you know, if I'm going to start my P2P tomorrow, the easiest thing is I just buy in some credit rating and use that. And then over time, I can aim left or right or up and down or that. So presumably over time, the internal models get hopefully more accurate. But there's a trade-off in terms of that they may also get too complex. There's this thing called overfitting. So you've got a bunch of data and, you know, the real thing might be a straight line, but actually you end up drawing a zigzag because the zigzag fits all the dots, whereas the straight line misses most of them.
So I think this is something you sort of allude to in your blogs. I think there's a mixture of data science and analysis and good old-fashioned
art
experience.
Art and science, yeah.
And the art is to say, let's try and create lines and curves and gradation rather than, as you describe, the data happens to inform a terribly sort of sawtoothed picture, that may just be a quirk of small numbers or a quirk of a sample. So it makes much more sense to apply some real-world experience and common sense to try and see things in terms of lines and grades and curves rather than very complicated patterns.
No, indeed. So coming back to the 2008 then, which was your great triumph in a sense, because I don't think anybody would have guessed. I mean, looking at the data here, for 2008, your expected defaults were 3.7% and your actual defaults were 5.7%. In almost every other year, it's been the other way around, that the actual defaults have been far less than the expected. But given what a difficult year it was...
And that 5.7 is a lifetime default, so they were, you know, 3-4 year loans. So the actual annualised losses on those loans were sort of 2 or 3. And at the time, 2008, remember what interest rates were pre-crisis, personal loan rates were quite high. So actually, the net performance in that cohort wasn't really materially any worse than any other.
Amazing. So obviously you were pleased about that, was good news, but were you surprised that, you know, what a stress test that is?
So if you'd looked at our credit performance during the middle of that year, we would have looked like we were doing better than we've ever done before, because losses typically take a year or so to come through. Yeah. The loans we wrote in 2008 were a higher coupon than the ones we wrote in 6 and 7. So actually, this is one of the dangers of looking at a static moment in time. So during 2008, we thought we were doing an amazing job because returns had gone up and none of the losses had come in. Now, when the losses started coming in 2009, 2010, we didn't know how bad it was going to turn out. And since they were the first significant losses we'd ever suffered, we were quite nervous. But we did have the context of knowing what had happened in the rest of the world. And therefore, we could say to ourselves, well, these are the worst losses we've ever suffered, but actually, they don't look too bad. And if we extrapolate them, they're not going to get too bad. And now we look at it 5 years later and say, well, that was actually quite a good performance. But at the time, again, perhaps it's down to our natural conservatism, it felt uncomfortable.
Yeah. So it's a bit like BSE, though. So, I mean, I remember 10 years ago, everybody's going to die from mad cow disease.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, it doesn't really get mentioned very much. But, I mean, you're in the super prime sector.
You also see in the numbers you've got in front of you, our risk appetite went up. So on the back of our extreme outperformance in 05, 06 and 07, we increased our risk appetite. So we consciously took a bit more risk, you know, with hindsight, exactly the worst time. We probably weren't alone in doing that in the world. But the actual performance was surprisingly good. We then lowered our risk appetite as quickly as we could, as you also see from those numbers, and arguably lowered it too far.
So putting this into context, the people who can't see these numbers, it's just the expected defaults. They're on the website of Zopa for anybody interested. Anybody who is into credit should actually check them out, because it's very interesting anyway. Putting that into context, because it may be misunderstood, the expected defaults that Zopa have been targeting over the last 10 years have basically ranged between about 1.5% and 3.5%.
Over the lifetime of the loan.
Over the lifetime of the loans. The actual defaults have most years been less than 1%. So we are talking about the super prime end. And going back to the subprime stuff, Prosper's big loss in its portfolio, worst cohort, was like 40%. You know, to put this into context, so you were over 10 times.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Difference in the credit spectrum. And coming back to your poking my ribs over my cynicism around risk, then I think that, you know, one of the key points that I'm just trying to remind people at the moment, and those people are less familiar than you with it, which is that 15 million web pages are wrong, because 15 million web pages tell you how to measure risk. You cannot measure risk, you can only have a model risk, and a model is never reality. And so if I say the rude bit first, I'll then say the polite bit second. So just to be rude, your credit models have sometimes been wrong by a factor of 10 in terms of the outcome. And so to be polite and put that into context for the audience, almost always you're 10 times too conservative.
Yeah, so I think we have been very conservative.
In the modelling of the expected defaults.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I think what you do is you set your risk appetite, and the model sets risk appetite, and then you set an operational process to deliver the performance of the model. And it's in the second point, I think, that we've been overly conservative. I think one of the benefits of longevity, I mean, it's not always best to be first, for the reasons you outlined in your introduction. Our industry's without doubt had a sort of inflection point of growth for us as well as everybody else when became joined by other people. But a benefit of longevity is that we have an enormous amount of data on the people we've declined over the years and what they went on to do. So what that allows you to do is make very informed decisions about increasing your risk appetite.
Absolutely. So you now know, for example, that the last thing you want to do is lend money to a podcaster, for example, because you've got tons of records of podcasters you turned down, they went somewhere else, and they're all a bunch of crooks and sharks.
If that were the case, I don't believe it for a second.
Or whatever the generalisation of that is. No, I can see it. It's a huge advantage. I mean, there's something in terms of these risk articles I'm writing for Altfire. I started at sort of 300,000 feet, got down to 30,000 feet, and then the last one was 3,000 feet. So the next one needs to be, mixing my metaphors, at the coal face. So I'm desperately looking for things really to worry about. And one of my big concerns, I think, in P2P is that I think you guys quote and everybody quotes on their website a nice big number, which is the expected return over 3 years or 5 years, which is the current yield minus fees minus expected defaults.
Yep.
As we've seen a million times over, the average investor or average member of the public just looks at the Sunday newspapers and sees a big number, 5, 6, or 7, oh, I'll go for 7. Now, one concern one has is that, as I say, just looking at these things here, that in general, your risk appetite or expected defaults has been much more conservative than the actual defaults. However, from a marketing perspective, if you're subtracting these conservative numbers from the current yield, then you are going to have a smaller headline rate than less conservative or slash more spivvy person whose expected default model is not very accurate.
Yeah.
Let's say, for the sake of argument, you and another shark that's setting up tomorrow both invest in loans yielding, say, 7%, for the sake of argument, and let's say the fees are 1%, so the net is 6. And you say, oh, well, you're expecting defaults of 2, and they say we're expecting defaults of 1/2. And then you go to some price comparison site or open your Sunday Telegraph and Zopa's on 3.5% and Mr. Spiv's on 5.
Yeah.
That rather concerns me. I'm not sure what we can do about it, but just showing my worry.
So I think you're right. It puts us at a disadvantage in the first presentation. I think people are pretty cautious by nature. I think people try typically a number of platforms at the same time. They have different experiences at different platforms. And I think at the end, quality will out. So I would much rather be at a slight marketing disadvantage and over-deliver in the long run, even if it causes me a little bit of pain in the short run. To take your point to its sort of ad absurdum.
My points are always ad absurdum in the start.
One of the platforms that launched and subsequently failed simply copied and pasted our risk warnings, our risk appetite, our expected losses in the days actually when we used to allow people to choose between different credit markets. And so the numbers there are sort of aggregation of different credit markets within the business. And you know, they called their risk grades the same as we called ours, and all the expectations were the same. Yeah, they had no moral behind it at all. And when I challenged them on it, they just said, yeah, but you've proven that A-star loans only default that much.
Oh, no.
So I'm sort of going, yeah, well, they're A-star loans that have been through a certain process.
Our definition of A-star.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, unsurprisingly, that business failed. But it will ever be thus. I think what the FCA are trying very hard to do, because this is a point they worry about, is they're trying very hard to get everyone to speak in the same language. And the PTPFA, which we were founding members of, have come up with a sort of common industry standard method of measuring default. So the table you've got in front of you with those numbers on it is replicated on each website. So there is some information there, and you will see surprising differences. If you go and look at the different platforms, you will see surprising differences in our performance with others. And I'm a believer that over time, these things will out.
Right, so the interesting point, just sticking on this one then, is around people's modelling of the expected defaults. I'll come back to where you started with in the end, which I agree with, which is that over time, things will sort themselves out. Although sometimes time has booms and busts before we get the sorting out thing. Now, why I'm concerned, not about Zopa in the slightest, because your data is here and you've been incredibly conservative and got 10 years history, but for the industry as a whole, of which there are 50 peer-to-peers out there, they're not all the same as you, is that back in the day, there was this thing called internal models approval process, going back to Banking Capital, Bol 2 or something like that, one of the millions of things that came out, said that banks are allowed to use their own internal models to do capital rather than VAR or something like that. And the Bank of England, I think it was the time, had this huge exercise of internal models approval process and blah, blah, blah. And I sat through painful meetings where people would argue whether it's pi over 4 or pi over 3.9 or all this kind of stuff. You know, meanwhile, I then go to another meeting where we're doing a $1 billion IPO, which wasn't covered by the regulation whatsoever, which could have bust the bank. And everyone's worrying about the decimal points. Anyway, quite some time later, there was a study done of the difference of internal modelling between all the, you know, the blue chip blanks, the class acts and that. Vast differences. And that's between blue chip, you know, Goldman's, Morgan Stanley, CSFBs, all this kind of stuff. So reasonable men can differ, and certainly reasonable credit people can differ over the expected default. So my concern is that if you come to the peer-to-peer industry as a whole, you're going to get some people who've got conservative models like yours. I will only know whether your 2015 projection is right in 5 years' time, or Mr. Spiv, you know, 5 years is a long time.
Yes. So, I mean, as you know, the industry is now regulated by the FCA. We're operating under an interim permission, and we'll be applying for full authorisation in August this year. And I'm hoping that as part of FCA authorization, that the regulators do actually come and take a look at the quality of the modelling. I think it's fine for people to have different views of the world. I don't want homogeneity. I don't want everyone to use the same tools. We all want to have differences. But I think the point is, I don't know the level of competence within organisations. I know the level of competence in ours, but I don't know the level elsewhere. And I think it would be a good thing for the regulator to take some view of that and to hold platforms to account. And I think this is a direction a regulator is going, in the sense they want common language, but I think they also want people to show evidence that their predictions are worthwhile. because if they're not worthwhile, then they shouldn't be allowed to publish any sort of expected return. Right. So, you know, if a platform is expecting losses of 3 and routinely delivers 5, yeah. they shouldn't be allowed to publish their predictions.
No,
they should be put on the naughty step, if you like, and told you can't make a, we can't make any promise of a predicted return until you've proven you know what you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, it's a whole podcast in itself going into all this sort of credit modelling and expected defaults and internal models approval process and back testing, which is the thing that happens in banks' capital. From a regulatory perspective, I've got a bit of a concern in that most of the people who did that kind of stuff are now in the PRA and moved over rather than the FCA. I think for listeners or investors, I think the main thing is that when you're looking at these platforms, you do have to actually look at the historic data and form your own conclusions over which platforms are conservative in their estimates and which platforms are not. And it does take time, and eventually it will come out in the wash, but it's rather like they say this about equity crowdfunding. The best answer so far, what's return from equity crowdfunding? Answer zero, because nobody's got any money back. And over time, we will see whether, for example, Seed has outperformed Crowdcube, but it may be 10 years, and by then it's too late.
I think the other thing that I would urge consumers to look for in evaluating their choice is to try and understand what the platform is actually doing with their money. And does that attune with their personal, either well-informed or ill-informed view of the world? So I think it's great that there are a number of different asset classes available to peer-to-peer finance, ranging from equity through SME lending, through obvious and declared property lending, to obvious and declared consumer lending like we do. I think they are all different asset classes. I think people do have different views on them. Some people particularly enjoy SME lending, perhaps because they're business people and they like to think that they've got a bit of an edge and they've got the time and it's fun. And actually, over time, I think the rewards to well-practiced SME lending are good. The risk-adjusted returns are good. I think the platforms will acknowledge they're higher risk, and therefore they need to be higher return to justify that risk. Similarly, you may have a very bullish view of the world in terms of property, and therefore you might choose, but don't even necessarily have to be very bullish, but you might not have a bearish view on property, and therefore you might say, well, I really want the security. To some people, that's very important, and that's a question of choice. I think where I really struggle is where consumers can't make that choice because they just don't know what the platforms are doing.
Well, it's like my mum, for example. You know, my mum shouldn't really go, nothing wrong with Funding Circle, wonderful company, they'll be on the show soon, but my mum shouldn't go to Funding Circle and start deciding whether to invest in B2s or C3s because she just hasn't got the background. She should, however, look at the likes of Zopra's rate setter because there's a number there and they'll be very safe and they've got provision funds and you know, it's just much easier. Whereas if you're a sort of city person, you might as well go and have a look at Funding Circle and think, oh, actually, you know, I'll put some of my money in there and
B2s. So that's half my point. Half my point is people should have the choice and make sensible choices about their view of the asset class. I think where I'm more concerned is where consumers can't even make the choice.
Meaning
that I think some platforms simply just don't declare what they're doing with the money. And I think that's a real worry. And I think that's something that in the event the platform doesn't deliver the expected returns, that's something I think the regulator will have a concern about because I don't think the consumer made an informed choice. If a consumer makes an informed choice to lend to consumers on Zopa and consumer debt does spectacularly badly, then I think they would have less grounds for complaint than if they had invested by accident in another asset class that they didn't know about.
Yeah, so I mean, just in terms of transparency, most of the ones I've looked at, but time is limited, so I haven't looked at many out of the 50, most of them are relatively transparent slash getting more transparent, notwithstanding the fact it's anonymised.
Yeah, I don't think it should remain anonymised. I mean, obviously in SME case it can't be, and there isn't the same data protection limitation. So if you're making a choice as to what business to lend to, you clearly need to know who they are. If you're lending to consumers, I think it's not desirable to know who they are, and you don't need to. But I think you do need to know that you're lending to people, and you need to know after the event what sort of loans you've got. So did I lend money to lots and lots of people borrowing £1,000? That feels a bit risky. Did I lend lots of money to people borrowing £8,000 to buy a car? That feels quite safe. What sort of credit grades of people did I lend to? What were the platform's expectations of losses per loan of the people I lend to? Is my portfolio getting riskier without me knowing about
yes.
it? Because the platform's changing its risk modelling?
Yes.
These are things I think people should be able to tell.
Absolutely. Well, let's see how that one goes, because again, that's kind of a podcast in itself.
There's a lot of noise in the industry about transparency, and that's what I mean by transparency,
right.
That people have a very clear sight of the kind of activity they were doing, at what sort of rates, what sort of margins, fees the platforms were making.
So wrapping up this point about transparency, how would you put it all together, Giles?
Well, I think my view is, as a lender, you're making a decision to lend on a platform, and you're accepting an expected level of return. So for example, on our site, you're expecting to make 5% over 5 years. I think it matters to you when you're making that decision whether the return you're getting of 5% is made up of consumers paying 30% or whether it's made up of consumers paying 7 or 8%. I think it matters whether your 5% is being generated from property loans, business loans, consumer loans, or whatever. I'm not saying any of those is right or wrong, but I think it matters to you to be able to tell.
Absolutely. I think that's a really well-made point. And again, transparency is something that's very complex that people on the inside of the industry have got a good understanding of it. From outside, there are these sort of various sort of seven veils you have to go through. So you can have complete transparency, as you say. You can have sort of partial transparency, which is, you know, it's going to consumers or something. And then you can have like a bank and the other extremists. No transparency. I stick my money into Barclays Bank. I don't know if it's going to weapons or blood diamonds or Colombian drug runners.
Which consumers are saying they don't like.
Absolutely, quite understandably. So time's going on. We've certainly drilled into some of these credit things, and as always, the more that one drills into them, the more that sort of one could keep talking about. But coming on to Zopa and going back to the future, Giles, have you got any plans to get back to 100% market share in the UK?
Not anytime soon, no. No. I mean, we're very happy that the market has a higher population, if you like. So we've acknowledged reluctantly that, yes, we're not going to be the only player. But we certainly have very strong plans to grow. But I think at the end of the day, our businesses are stock businesses, not flow businesses. So ultimately, we're trying to build loan books. So the interesting numbers to look at are how fast a loan book's growing or shrinking. And my ambition and aspiration for Zopa is to be regarded as the people who did it best. Yep. In the long run, that quality will out. So in 10 years' time, I want Zopa to be acknowledged widely as the people who did peer-to-peer lending best. And I think as a result of that, we will probably, not necessarily, we will probably be the biggest as well. But to me, that's much less relevant metric than quality. It's perhaps easy for me to say that because we are currently the biggest.
You have been the best over the last 10 years and your ambition is to be the best over the next 10 years. And in terms of continuing this growth path, one of the things that I hear around the bazaars is that, oh yes, well, Zopa did very well in the usual sort of damning with faint praise. Oh, but that's because they chose the very best borrowers in the country and they've used all of them up. So, you know, how much of these sort of super prime borrowers are left and how much of a sort of ceiling is that on your growth?
So we have a fantastic bedrock of incredibly prime borrowers who we certainly wish to maintain. The opportunities to grow in that world are perhaps more limited than in the wider market, but we will certainly be doing our best to continue to get a great share of that because I think it's a fantastic foundation for our business. But it's only a foundation. And it, you know, the marketing channels we use and the traffic we generate isn't all those people. So as I said before, we have a huge and increasing pool of data of people who we have not chosen to do business with. And over time, we will extend our model to be able to serve more people sensibly, and we will use the powers of, I think, the best data analytics in the business, the best pool of data, and some smart, more artistic type people, to use your language.
With eyebrows.
With eyebrows, indeed. To build a more inclusive and more widely serving business. And I think that's really the opportunity for growth.
Excellent. Well, that's a very good note to wrap up on, and I've certainly enjoyed talking today, and I'm sure the listeners have learned quite a lot and given them some new things to think about the whole industry and how it all works. And I wish you well over the next 10 years.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. by with the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.